Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Speak Beastie for March 12th, 2017.
I'm Ariel.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Michael.
And we have a special guest back with us, Stephanie. Say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Yay.
Hi.
So, when was the last time, other than New York Comic Con, that you were with us?
The Puckwudgie.
Oh, man. Whoa. Yeah. What episode even was that?
It was early on, and the only reason I remember was because we decided it was an evil Sonic the Hedgehog.
Good times.
We're not a young podcast like we once were.
Oh,
speaking of not being young, it's Michael's birthday!
Yay!
As Lizzie remembered, this is my second time recording an episode of Speak Beastie on my birthday.
You just
wait. Was it Speak Beastie though?
I thought it was. I was pretty sure.
I thought it was Aloha Mora.
Was it? I thought it was Speak Beastie.
Hold on.
It could have been.
Let's look.
I remember you guys specifically saying happy birthday to me.
Let's look this shit up.
Yes, it was episode 7, Porpentina Ate a Bagel, because Ariel Ariel was like, the birthday fairy.
Aren't I always?
Because it was my, and because it's also close to Shannon's, or no, we were talking about Shannon's birthday because that's the time that Ariel met Shannon, was around her birthday.
And you, that was the same day.
And I was with you.
Yeah.
Yes, but then you talked to me on Speak Beastie on my birthday, and that's what makes you the birthday fairy.
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm the birthday fairy, and that's my present, is you get to see me, and that's the wish that I grant. So that's good. I hope that's what
okay.
you wanted.
Okay, hold on. You can imitate any voice ever, any time in the world, and that's what you make me sound like?
You should go listen to how you said it on the episode. That's pretty much how you said it. I'll let the listeners take care of that
I
one for
doubt you, Michael.
I'm going back and I'm actually listening to all of the episodes again. So,
oh, you miss me that much.
Yes, that's how often we do. That's how little we get to talk.
Yeah, well, not my fault, but we're not going to get into this right now. Because it's your birthday and we're recording. So,
yeah, I'm so excited. I love recording on my birthday.
Apparently, you do it all the time.
Yes. And also, thank you to all of the, first of all, thank you guys for the shout out on Twitter. And thank you to all of the Speak Beastie and Aloha Mora listeners who also wished me a happy birthday. It's pretty wild when you're getting happy birthday wishes from like all over the world. That's crazy and also wonderful. So thank you for that. And thank you for listening.
Must be That's so all. Nice to be loved.
You would know, wouldn't you, from all the affection that I send your way?
Oh, no, I was talking about all the people who hate me, but that's cool, too. Yeah.
No, people don't like me, too. That's fine. I have a review on Aloha Mora where, like, whoever reviewed it went through every host and, like, talked about how great they are, which they are. But then they ended it with saying it was great the way they ended it. They said, too bad. It's becoming less Aloha Mora and more the Michael Harley Show.
I would attend anything called the Michael Harley Show. What? Right? They
Find
say that like it's a
up.
Bad thing.
I really apologize for talking on a podcast because
that's what
what's left
to
if
do.
There's no talking. Just saying.
How about don't listen? There's an idea. Clog up your ears like me and just don't listen.
Miss Ariel's recovering from a very, well, way too long clogged ear.
You know, things just happen and life slips by, and it's only when you wake up with your ear hurting so bad that you think, I should probably get this checked out.
Well, we're so glad that you're here to hear this episode. God, why?
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as $1 a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more! Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees, and how.
And now for the Phoenix Register. So, unfortunately, last time we had an episode, it was the day before Oscars, or the day of the Oscars, I think. So they didn't get to discuss that Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them actually won an Academy Award for costume design.
We won!
Yes.
Yay. We won.
We did it, guys!
We were all up there.
Granted, we have been praising Colleen Atwood's pretty much since the start, since we found out she was going to be doing the costumes, because of all of her previous work and everything. But yeah, she got on that stage, accepted that award, and she actually, when she went backstage, said there's so much incredible kind of artistry in the Harry Potter movies, but she also suggested that having Fantastic Beasts set in the 20s keyed off a different sort of visual sense that probably helped boost this film in the Academy Awards and had it win. She still said she was shocked the design teams behind the Harry Potter films were never honored by an Oscar, which I think we can all agree with that. She said, I can't believe they never won for that incredible clockwork creation of Stuart Craig in the Harry Potter movies. And I think we all have something that we took from the original films and thought, like, oh, this should have won an Oscar. Like, this should have won something.
See? Even Colleen Atwood is like, yeah, Prisoner of Azkaban. That's yeah. The one. Yeah. There's a reason that we love Grave so much, and it's not just because he's Colin Farrell. We love that coat.
Oh,
I was gonna say, I want Newt's coat.
Newt's coat is pretty cool too. Even especially when you look at the behind the scenes stuff that didn't make it in, where he had all those pockets in the coat and everything.
Yeah, just what I need. Because girls' pockets suck.
Yeah, that was a deserving win.
But speaking of awards, Fantastic Beasts is also nominated for 7 Saturn Awards. The categories are as follows: Best Fantasy Film, Best Supporting Actor, our guy Dan Fogler, Best Production Design, Stuart Craig, who Colleen Atwood mentioned, Best Film Music, James Newton Howard, Best Costumes, yet again, for Colleen Atwood, Best Makeup, Nikki Knowles, and Best Special Effects, Tim Burke, Christian Manns, and David Watkins. So, I think, hopefully, we could see Fantastic Beasts winning a few more awards at the Saturn Awards show, unless something happens and they, I don't know, don't, which would be with
awful.
With 7 nominations, they stand a good chance.
Yeah, looking at the competition in some of these categories, probably their biggest competition in fantasy film might be I'd say from this list, The Jungle Book or A Monster Calls. The rest probably aren't going to win.
Just
being frank. Things don't win, guys. Get used to it. We're from the Harry Potter fandom. We know when things don't win. Truth. The truth hurts.
Don't it just.
Don't
it. You can either learn from it or run from it.
Oh, there you go.
We also got some information about J.K. Rowling and the Occamy and how she kind of came up with it and the hard-to-pronounce word that it is. Rowling explained that the idea came from a popular myth that fish only grow to fit the space available to them. I want to pause that real quick because I had never heard that before and I thought that was really interesting.
Never heard that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
And I think it's cool that she tied that into this mythical creature. And, you know, obviously we see the Occamy grow to fit the big building and then also to shrink down to fit into the teapot. So continuing on, she said, so without a word already in use to explain such a phenomenon, she invented her own, and Eddie Redmayne pronounces it as Chironaptixic. So that's how we're going to pronounce it from now on, if we can remember. We may need to have, like, a guide for whatever we bring it up. Chironaptixic. But I trust...
It'll help once we have the Blu-ray, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
I trust Eddie. I trust him.
It's a made-up word, and he was the first person to pronounce it, so it's all his.
Yeah.
True. Very true.
Chironaptixic.
So we did actually get two deleted scenes, the first one being of the demiguys being chased through the store. Was it a Macy's? It was like a Macy's. It was that sort of thing. So if you want to go watch that, be sure to go to MuggleNet and the Fantastic Beasts film series tag and find the article titled Demiguys Deleted Scene. And you can watch it right there. And... does anybody have any comments what they think about this deleted scene? Like, should they have kept it? Was it good that they cut it? How do you feel?
So I watched them both, and the demiguys, I think out of the both of them, I would have preferred if they had kept the demiguys, if I had to pick between the two, just because it's more action. You know, it's purely there for more humor and to show that the rampant and the destruction that the demiguys unintentionally can cause from, you know, knowing what's going to happen. And this is, I think Dan mentioned this when he was on the show about how he was like pulled through the store.
Yeah.
And you see that in the scene and you see the Debbie guys like pulling him all over the place. And it's very funny and enjoyable. Whereas the scene with the Runespore, gosh, I hope I can say that right. Cause that's my whole section.
That's how I've been pronouncing it. I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Where the Runespore, it's just a continuation of when they're going through the case for the first time. And it's just these snakes popping out from behind. And Jacob's all, I'm afraid of snakes, but this is really cool. And because it's like three tiny snakes.
Ooh.
And then like three huge snakes come up behind him while he's not looking. Newt's like, that's nice. Let's keep going. Before he turns around and freaks out. So they're really small, but they're cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think the first scene I would have kept between the two of them, the demiguy scene, because it gives Jacob and Queenie a little bit more of something to do in that moment, because they just like walk off in that scene.
Yeah.
and then it's just Newt and see, that's still my problem that I've had more and more as I've seen Beasts more and more, is that there's some really shoddy editing going on in that movie, and there's just a lot of moments where they're like, we don't know what to do with Queenie and Jacob, so we'll just not have them here. So but apparently they were there, and it was, that was a nice, I liked that bit with that scene, and it kind of set up the demiguise's ability a little better.
Yeah.
And it gave it a little more kind of foreshadowing for what was going to happen upstairs when they encounter the Akami. But yeah, the rune spore is purely just a visual gag. And while I know, and I'm sure Lizzie will tell us more about this in the Newt case, but while I know rune spores can get big, I don't think they're supposed to get that big. Like, that was ridiculous. It was like, it looked like the Hydra from Hercules. Like, it was...
Yes! That is it! Oh, my... Ripped right out of that Disney flick right there.
Yeah, it was
cut
a little...
Cut and paste.
It was a little much. Yeah.
But you should all still go watch them, because they are enjoyable, and they were filmed, and people worked very hard on it.
That's right. But hey, if they haven't gotten to look at it on MuggleNet yet, there's an opportunity for them to see those deleted scenes soon, right? Right?
So for our final bit of news, since we just talked about the film, it is actually out for digital download right now if you want to go check it out. It won't be out on DVD until later in the month, so you have to wait for that. But if you're a fan of digital download anyway, then it all works out. So that's it for this episode's Phoenix Register. Stephanie, you want to take it away with the outpost?
Yes. The first question we have is from Igor, actually.
Hi,
so,
Igor.
Thank you for putting up with us. Thank you for putting up with us and asking questions. And he says, what if Newt is involved with the whole Grindelwald thing because he also wants to study the Obscurus? We know he has an interest in it. And since Leeta is a friend of his that also likes studying creatures, maybe they meet again because of the same interest. So while Grindy is looking to conquer the Obscurus for evil reasons, Newt and Leeta just want to study it. Or maybe Grindy hires Leeta to study the Obscurus for him because he is some kind of magizoologist like Newt. If Newt and Tina are already in a relationship in film 2, then that's easy to bring Queenie on board and in consequence, bring Jacob too.
I just want to...
First of all... Ooh. I like that you called him Grindy.
Grindy.
I
call Dumbledore Dumby, so this is great.
I'm reading what was written. That is exactly how it was written.
It's very... See, and it... I'm so used to people call... You know, people call Voldemort Voldy.
Yeah.
But, like, the what... It's throwing me off because I'm like, Grindy Low?
That's what I was thinking.
You're talking about... No? Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. It trivializes him in a way. Like, Grindy. Voldy. Like, you can't be scared of somebody like, hi, I'm Grindy. I'd be like, okay, buddy. Cool. You're Johnny
but
Depp.
But also,
all right.
That's a great idea on Igor's part. Because...
Yeah, true.
I personally am still kind of boggled at the fact that there's going to be so many more movies in the series, because unlike Harry Potter, I'm not really feeling as tied to the overarching mystery of whatever she's trying to set up with beasts. Especially, I think, partially because we know what the end game is, generally. Yeah. So this is kind of a nice way to, like, Igor kind of picked up on pretty much all the things, like, all the characters he named, Newt, Grindelwald, Leeta, and by proxy, Credence, are all the characters that are the only continuing threads of this film. Like, everything else is wrapped up within the first film. So, like, the only other thing that's a quote-unquote mystery is what'll happen with Queenie and Jacob.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a... Because I have, otherwise, I wouldn't have any idea of how Leeta comes into the storyline.
You know, talking about the Obscurus, and this is, I don't know, I guess this isn't something I thought about before this comment that Igor left us, but it's still not really clear to me how or why Newt acquired the Obscurus that he did have, because I don't think, I mean, yeah, to a degree, he's interested in many curiosities, but it's not a beast per se. Like, I don't think the Obscurus is an animal. Like, it's a magical force of some sort. And so that's why I'm like, he kept it in the same space where he keeps all of his animals. I don't really know how that ties in. And I don't know. I know a lot of it boils down to Joe starting to write and being like, oh, I can bring this in and then this can tie into this. And her head just probably started spinning with ideas. And that was when she decided to involve Grindelwald and Dumbledore and all of these other aspects. So I don't know. I would like for it to be better explained why these two very entirely different people, Newt and Grindelwald, do have this sort of, I don't want to say like attraction, but interest in the Obscurus, other than the fact that it is so mysterious.
And I think that's part of the reason why Newt is attracted to it, because his main thing is going out and exploring and learning about all of these creatures that the magical world kind of shuns and like puts away, and they're just like, it's dangerous, I don't want to deal with it. And to an extent, the Obscurus is sort of similar in a way, because it's dangerous. No one really knows much about it. No one knows exactly what it is other than the suppressed magical energy.
Yeah.
So I feel he's just trying to do the same thing that he does for his beasts and tries to tame it to a certain degree and figure out what properties it may possess that could end up helping the wizarding community and not just destroying it.
Yeah. I was thinking what you said, Stephanie, with that attraction to kind of the unknown and trying to explain it. A big thing in films is that the villain of the film, the perceived villain or complication of the film, is supposed to actually in many ways mirror the hero. And the movie clearly explains that Newt considers himself to be misunderstood and kind of out of touch with, quote-unquote, everyday people. And the whole movie is filled with kind of social outcasts. Rowling has even said that kind of everybody in the film is a little bit on the fringe of society. And so that the metaphor fits. And then I think the literal reason also might be that, at least within the canon and the concept, I thought might be that Newt wanted to definitively figure out whether the Obscurus was a living creature. Because he didn't seem, his story kind of suggested that he happened upon an Obscurus and he didn't fully understand what it was and assumed that it could have possibly been a living entity on its own, but he confirms in the film that it's not when you separate it from the host and that it's actually a parasite. So I could see that he might have thought it was a creature because everybody else thinks it's a creature. Grindelwald is able to fool the whole wizarding community of New York into thinking it's a creature. So
I agree with that. I don't think like Newt like went looking for an Obscurus. Mm-mm. He was probably just out doing his thing, looking for beasts, and came upon the girl. And we've said before, Newt doesn't seem necessarily, he's more attached to his beasts than other humans. And, you know, we've said, right? That seems right, that we've said it before.
Yeah, definitely.
Like he's more of a beast person than, you know, making personal connections with other witches and wizards. So I think that something about that young girl really stuck with him, because when he's talking about her and the Obscurial and everything, and how, you know, she passed away, he's definitely more in touch with the experience than I think other personal interactions. So it almost seems like it's like that side project to figure out exactly what it is. So I agree with what Michael's saying 100%.
Yeah.
Curiosity. The next one we have is from David, and he says, I was thinking about the conversation about the White River Monster and the Muggle law prohibiting hunting them. This raised a really fascinating question for me that I've had about the magical world before. Are wizards bound by the laws of the non-magical countries in which they live? Maybe the reason the White River Monster spines are no longer used in wand making is less because no one other than the Thiago Quintana could figure out how to catch one, and more because the wizards were required to follow that law of the land prohibiting them from hunting the White River Monster. It wouldn't be the first example of wizards using logic to cover something up they'd rather ignore, their laws being secondary to Muggle laws.
I mean, it makes sense considering there is no reason that the wizards had to follow prohibition.
Yeah.
But they did. They still had speakeasies.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just all about, like, blending in.
Yeah. I mean, I like to think that if that's the case, they couldn't touch the monster because that's what the thing says, which makes me think to endangered animals. So would it be the same as for, like, poachers? Are they not allowed to use parts of those animals because they're endangered, and it would go against Muggle law?
I think this is a really great explanation and theory. Thank you, by the way, David. I appreciate this thought, having been the host who researched the White River Monster for the last episode. And that is an interesting idea, because from the movie we get from Newt the idea that no wizarding nation in any of the wizarding governments in any country are particularly interested in magical animal preservation anyway. He suggests that they all just exterminate them and that his goal is to try and make that stop. So it would be an interesting to suggest that, like, the Muggles actually are the nomads in this case, forced wizards to stop going after the creature. Although I want to say that ban was, I don't remember when that ban on the White River Monster occurred on bothering it. I don't know if that was around Newt's time or later. Oh, yeah, that happened much later. That occurred in 1973. So, that bill hasn't been signed.
Maybe by that time, then they are following
mm-hmm.
the laws more so than they would be normally, or they're adapting the conservation laws that the Muggles are putting out and applying them to their own magical creatures.
Yeah, it wouldn't line up quite with Thiago Quintana, at least as far as we know, because Thiago was farther back in time than 73, at least from what's been implied. So that might not be the case, but I'm not sure. There's no definitive timeline on that. But good theory, David.
Very good theory. And that concludes the Owl Post. Now on to the main discussion.
So for this episode's main discussion, we want to first thank Kitty Sneed. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly. If not, I'm sorry. But we appreciate you emailing us and giving us an idea on who we are discussing this week. So Kitty says, I think you should discuss Mary Lou, as she is one of the main antagonists in the film, and I'm interested to hear more about her in the Second Salemers. One connection I would love to have discussed is from the start of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. This is from page 76 in my edition, and is from when the trio is looking around the camping grounds at the Quidditch World Cup. A group of middle-aged American witches sat gossiping happily beneath a spangled banner stretched between their tents, which read, The Salem Witches Institute. Now, of course, a group of witches wouldn't be promoting the extermination of witches, so perhaps a group to counteract the anti-witch opinions. And at that point in time, are there still Second Salemers in America set out to persecute witches? It would be lovely to hear you guys discuss this, smiley face. Thank you, Kitty. and we will talk a little bit about our thoughts on that group from Goblet of Fire. But first, let's bring it back to Mary Lou. So Mary Lou Barebone was the leader of the Second Salemers during the time that Newt Scamander was in New York. and she was a nomad. Her birth date is unknown. She is a descendant of Bartholomew Barebone, who we read about in Pottermore. He was a scourer. I have such trouble with that word. Scourer?
You said it beautifully, considering okay. that mm-hmm. it is a horrible, horrible yeah. word.
I have trouble with the double R's.
No, yeah, it is a workout.
Yeah, scourer. Regardless, she had three adopted children, Chastity, Modesty, and Credence. She was portrayed by actress Samantha Morton. The character of Mary Lou Barebone died on December 7th, 1926. We know because it was in the movie. Not much is really known about her in the movie, or even when you look. There's nothing about her on Pottermore, and all of the information given on the wiki is pretty much from the movie.
So as you said before, it's quite, the conversation about her is quite...
bare-boned.
Oh, God. It was funny the first time, and it's funny now.
Oh, Michael.
It's still funny.
We do
J.K. Rowling's listening, and she was like, that's it! That's the joke! They got it!
I would hate for her to hear me on this podcast sounding like an idiot. we just know a few things about her. She was attacked by Tina when she was an Orr, another double R word. She spoke directly to Newt Scamander, not knowing that he was a wizard. We really didn't get much of Mary Lou, even though when we first started this podcast, we were like, oh, she's going to be big trouble. And we we really didn't get a lot of her. The shift was focused way more on Credence and eventually Grindelwald. But Steph had a comment that I think we should cover first, and then we can bring it back to Kitty's Goblet of Fire remark.
I just thought of a couple random things as I was reading about Mary Lou, and mm-hmm. it was, if she was so against wizards and she hated wizards so much, why would she purposely adopt magical children and deal with the potential of the random magic happening? And then furthermore, if she really wanted to be taken seriously as proving wizards and witches do exist and that they're a problem, why didn't she try to use and exploit her children as proof that magic existed instead of trying to beat it out of them? And then that triggered a connection to Umbridge yeah. from Harry Potter in my mind, with the physical, mental, and emotional abuse that she inflicts on her adopted children. So those are the questions that popped up into my head. I don't know what you guys think about those.
You know, I feel like one of your questions actually answered one of your questions, which is that I feel like the reason she would purposefully adopt magical children, if she did in fact know, because it's kind of ambiguous whether she did or not.
Pottermore says she knew.
Oh, does Pottermore say she knew?
Pottermore well, then said if she knew.
If she knew, then to me it suggested that, like you said in your second question, she intended to beat the magic out of them. And I think that is actually more very akin, I think, to the Dursleys.
Yes.
In that they're, and Rowling has said that about the Dursleys on Pottermore, is that they were very their ignorance of magic was so great that they thought they could literally beat the magic out of Harry, mm-hmm. that they could just make him not be magical anymore by pretty much denying that element of him. And Mary Lou also has kind of a, this is another one of my issues with the film. It's interesting how it's approached, but in some ways it's a little too vague. She's kind of portrayed like a religious zealot, and except it's not explicitly stated that what her denomination is, or if that's even her motivation. But there's definitely parallels to that to that idea. That, and you know, again, to clarify, not knocking religion, more so kind of criticizing institutionalized religion over religion itself. And there are certain ways that people practice religion that can be abusive and dangerous. And I think Mary Lou is meant to be a mirror of that. She just doesn't really, it's never explicitly stated what that reference is. But I think that's kind of where that comes from as far as why she did it on purpose. If she were saying more religious-like things, she would probably be saying something about God's will, kind of stuff, I feel like.
But then doesn't that just prove magic if she is beating out of it and if she can figure out a way to control it and there is a way for it to be controlled? Doesn't that just prove her point that the magic is dangerous if it can be controlled? Because I feel like that's part of her thing, is if it's chaos, she doesn't really know how to deal with it. But if she's able to control it in her children,
but she thinks she has it under control. That's the thing, is it's not so much that she thinks that she's got it under control, and she's like, yeah, the Dursleys, she's kind of foolish in that respect while she's preaching about how out of control it is.
But if she has that like visual representation of quote unquote the control in her children, and she sees that it can at least sometimes be controlled, it doesn't make it as chaotic or as dangerous as I feel like she's trying to make it out to be, if she has that demonstration of control in her children.
Yeah, but I feel like you're, I don't know the term I'm looking for, but she doesn't seem to follow much logic or reason. If she cared about those things, if she was like, ah, I see. So if he went to a wizarding school, everything would be all okay. He could control his magic. Like, no, she's just mad. She's just mad in general that magic even exists. That the fact that it's out there and it's physically in her blood to seek it out and want to eradicate it. Like, that's what the Scourers are. And I think a lot of it... And again, with the parallels with the Dursleys, maybe part of it's jealousy as well, that, you know, she could not be a part of this world where, you know, magic exists for her, where it exists for these children, and she wants to control it as best as she can, which is controlling them. Like, I don't necessarily see her... I don't see her as a logical person. I don't know. And I don't think it's like, you know, either or. You can only be logical or emotional. Like, you can absolutely be both. But I think she does rely more on her emotions in the movie, because she seems very stoic when she's speaking with her children, and even when she's like asking for the belt from Credence, for a moment that we know, like, is about to happen, and it's a very intense moment, and she's just like got no expression on her face, basically. And I think she bottles up her emotions in the way that Credence is forced to bottle up his magic, and that's why her anger bursts forth and his magic, you know, comes out of him in spurts. And it's just, I don't know. I started going off on this tangent, but
no. I think what you're saying, Ariel, and what Steph was the question Steph was asking was a good one, because I think it gets down to what, again, one of my problems with the film was, and one of the problems with Mary Lou is that really, I mentioned this on the last episode I was on, that when I took my parents to see Fantastic Beasts, I asked them if they liked it, and they were like, yeah, we had no idea what was happening, but it was enjoyable. And one of the biggest problems with the Scourers and the Second Salemers is that they are almost completely purely explained via Pottermore. There is little to no explanation of them in the film. And even with their explanation, I think a lot of Potter fans have agreed that the Scourer explanation is really shoddy and confusing. And unlike most things in Rowling's writing, it doesn't really have a parallel to the Muggle world. At least not a prominent one that people have latched on to.
Like whenever I heard of it, I thought of like Van Helsing and like vampire hunters and stuff like that. Like this is already a myth. And now we're just adding it on top of other myths. Like, you know, you watch, I'm bringing in like my horrible taste in TV shows, but like Vampire Diaries and Teen Wolf, like there's always someone who's like, it's in our blood to hunt these creatures. Like it, and that's just, you know, the explanation that's given. And I think it's kind of like, I want more. I'm just like, like why though? Like really, really why? Like tell me why. Don't just brush it off we're born this way to hate magic and I don't know.
Yeah, I think a lot of audience members, both Potter fans and casual fans, were asking why when Mary Lou showed up, because it's just not really well explained. And like I said, it's like Rowling wanted to do a parallel of a kind of religious extremist, but she didn't really make the motivations clear, and she ended up putting almost all any explanation that was provided on Pottermore outside of the film, which makes it even more confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So, because it's a shame too, because I do think that who is the actress, Samantha Morton, who played Mary Lou? And she was excellent.
Yeah.
She was really good. And it's such a shame that, and to me, that the character wasn't given more, because really I thought she was a more compelling antagonist than the true antagonist of the film.
Yeah.
I thought a lot of the stuff with the Second Salemers and Mary Lou and Credence was really interesting, and there just wasn't really enough explanation of why is this happening?
Yeah. The actress was definitely underutilized, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime her presence like was on screen, you just were like, oh man. Like, and when someone gives you that reaction when they just appear on screen and you're like, ah, what's she gonna do this time? I like having that kind of antagonist. And with Graves / Grindelwald, it wasn't always so certain until the end, and then I groaned for different reasons. But yeah, now that's a conversation for another day.
The thing with Mary Lou is I'm in the same situation as pretty much everyone that we've been talking about, is I just don't know enough. I want to know. And, there's so many more things I'm sure Rowling could tell us, and the chances of us getting that information is very slim, probably, at this point, considering the character is, you know, deceased and not going to be in the next film. You know, obviously not going to be in the next few films. Maybe we'll get a little bit of backstory should we see Modesty again. Maybe we'll get some more through Credence, but it just seemed like a wasted opportunity. I just wish they would have done more with the screen time to give more information. So, like you said, so it made more sense in the film that you walked out and you're like, I get that part of the plot. I get that subplot now. Because even friends and family, when they went to see it, they're like, I didn't get it. And I was like, I understand. I get that you didn't get it, because I still don't really get it.
Yes, I can barely explain it. Please, listeners, don't ask us to do an episode on chastity, because then we really got nothing.
She basically didn't even exist. Like,
she had one line and then she died. So shame.
And it was an off-screen death, basically. Like,
yeah, she is assumed to be dead, pretty much, for the most part.
Goodness. So many loose ends.
But also back to Kitty's point too about the Salem Witches Institute.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That was a great connection there, because especially because I think we've talked more about the Salem Witches Institute mostly as wasn't that supposed to be the American Wizarding School?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this did Kitty just call JKR out on her
Rowling. Oh yeah, so a lot of people have been very confused by this, and Rowling ended up clarifying this a little bit, because what happened was, before Goblet of Fire came out, people were asking her about other wizarding schools, and of course, you know, mostly a lot of people wanted to know about the American Wizarding School, if there was one. She said, oh, you'll find out, you'll see other ones in book four. And so then that got brought up, and everybody was like, that's it, that's the school. And then she was just like, no, no. And she's clarified recently. She said, that's a joke, because it's a play on it's like the British Women's Institute or something like that. There's a Women's Institute in
something
the UK.
That us Americans would not get.
Yes. And it's a pun on that. But I believe the Women's Institute is kind of a women's cause group. They fight for women's rights, as I understand it. Don't quote me on that, UK listeners. Maybe you can research that a little more for me. I have learned from my years of podcasting, if there's one thing I've learned, don't trust anything I say, because I probably just made it up. But yeah, that was the pun. So the Salem Witches Institute is not meant to be a school in that sense.
My thought was, what if it was a spin on like Muggle or Nomadge sororities, and what if it was like descendants of those that were persecuted during the Salem Witch Trial?
Ooh.
And they have their own little club.
That would be cool.
It's a very interesting club.
It is a very interesting club, but you know how, Lizzie, I don't know if legacies are a thing.
Oh, they're a thing.
Yeah, but kind of like that, where they originally formed this club. Like, haha, we all got tried and got off, and they didn't get us, and we formed this club, and now all of our descendants are grandfathered in, and...
Yeah. I get what you're saying. I'm not going to go into it, but I get what you're saying.
I know. I know I'm not right in that sense, but that's the way it's working in my head.
You're on the right track. You just know that I could go on for hours on the Greek system, so I'm just not even going to start with it.
I like that
idea,
though.
I get exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see it as kind of like from Steph's viewpoint, like if that's what it was, if it was like, oh, we're descendants of these group of witches who survived, like I think that's so cool. I think it's a different take on because in the wizarding world, you know, there's this big thing about purebloods, and like I think that would be a different spin on it, where like we're survivors and we have this club because, you know, our ancestors went through a tough time, and that's putting it super lightly, but you know what I mean.
Well, that's a great way to connect it to Kitty's kind of suggestion of what it is, because as Kitty puts it, it might be a group of witches who counteract anti-witch opinions, and specifically ones that would have stemmed from Salem.
Yeah. Because, like, the pureblood families are just kind of high and mighty for no reason. Like, ooh, we're incestuous. and I that's why I like the idea of kind of an institute that maybe does fight for the rights of other witches and wizards, because they're descendants of witches who were persecuted during the biggest, you know, time when witches were persecuted, like a notorious moment in history for America, was the Salem Witch Trials. So I don't know. I like that spin on it. I can't say I have a different opinion, because honestly, the Salem Witches Institute flew right over my head when I first read Goblet of Fire when I was like 12. And I guess I never really thought too much about an American wizarding school, because I was like, I'd want to go to Hogwarts anyway. But I like it as something positive, something that's not that is exclusive, but not in the way that's like, you can't be in our club. Like, you know, I don't know.
You can't fit with us.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't magic with us.
Yeah, I'm surprised she actually didn't use the opportunity of the first movie to even bring them up, because that would have been another fun kind of Easter egg for the Potter fans.
Yeah.
To kind of get a little more about that. And if there is a relation to the second Salemers, maybe they are like in direct opposition to the second Salemers.
Yeah.
In their own little way. So who knows? Well, you know who knows. J.K. Rowling knows. That's a dumb question. She knows everything.
Who knows? We know who knows.
We know who knows.
So that's it for this episode's main discussion. Remember, if you have any character or really any topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to email
us. Except chastity.
Yes. Except chastity. She will never be discussed.
Unless her actress would like to come on the show and tell us more.
Yeah, maybe there was a lot that was cut that we just don't know about. But now, if you want to take it with the time turner, Michael.
Yes, and it's just also fitting what we've been discussing with Mary Lou, and coupled with me not knowing anything as I speak, because we're going to time turner it way back. I'm breaking Shannon's tradition. She can call me out on that later.
But it's your birthday. It's fine.
So the rules, that's right. So the rules don't apply, and I borrowed Lucius Malfoy's rule-breaking cursed child time turner to go wherever I want, because I can. And we're going to go way back to 1692, because we are going to discuss the Salem witch trials. And we're going to discuss the Salem witch trials not only because it is super relevant to the previous discussion, but also because I need to apologize to, I don't know, everybody who is dead who was involved in Salem and their descendants, because apparently I knew nothing about Salem, although I sure thought I did when I was on my first episode, and I just rambled away about how they burned witches, which they didn't. They hung them.
Granted.
Which you're going to learn more about. Fun stuff. But to be fair, Pottermore did not help with their art, their yes. artistic license.
Exactly.
But to give a little background, before we'll go back even a little farther before February of 1692 and look at the underlying causes of the Salem witch trials. There were multiple causes. But a few of the major ones, one of them was actually a specific individual named Joseph Glanville, who was a clergyman and writer, and he pushed the idea that to be religious and believe in God and angels necessitated a belief in witches, demons, and sorcery, which he wrote in Against Modern Sadism in 1668. So Joseph Glanville was doing nothing to help. He basically said, if you want to be religious and go to heaven, then you gotta believe that witches exist. So, simultaneously, the poor Puritans, and if you want to know more about the Puritans, I have a little bit about them here, but my God, there was just nothing good about their lives once they moved over to the U.S. You gotta give them credit for sticking around. They were in a war with the French, and the French and the Puritans had kind of caught the indigenous tribes of the Americas in the middle, of course, and this caused a lot of xenophobia as refugees were flooding colonies and Native Americans were attacking settlements because the French extended a hand to the Native Americans and then used them to attack the Puritan settlements. To add to all of these problems, Salem, when people say Salem, that doesn't necessarily encompass what we're talking about, because back then there was a place called Salem Village and there was a place called Salem Town, and they were distinctly different places, and they were having a dispute with each other over land, property lines, grazing rights, and church privileges. And Reverend Samuel Parris, who had a lot to do with the Salem witch trials, did nothing to help once he was put on as reverend in Salem Village. He only increased village tensions by pointing out individuals in the village who had done nothing wrong and exacerbating their minor infractions into major ones. And again, adding another layer to this horrible, horrible sandwich, Salem Village not only was having disputes with Salem Town, but they were also having their own internal disputes. And the townspeople were very easily prone to mass hysteria and arguments in the streets, because they all knew each other's business and they took sides with each other's arguments. All of that said, it was the perfect fuel for the fire, and probably the icing on the cake was that this was all really started by two little girls who decided to be brats. And they were Elizabeth, better known as Betty Page, who was 9 years old, and Abigail Williams, who was 11. And the two young ladies, who were, I believe, cousins, decided to suffer uncontrollable fits, it would seem. As far as historians can decide, they were either afflicted with something that the Puritans didn't understand, or they were just making it up, which is the more likely thing that was going on. And in their fits, they decided to accuse three women named Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and a slave named Tituba of witchcraft. Both Sarahs denied the accusations, while Tituba confessed immediately. But in doing so, she was attempting to act as an informer to save herself. And I believe Tituba, out of these three women, is the only one who made it out alive of this group of women who were accused first. And in April of 1692, ooh, not 1962.
That's, time jump. That,
in April of 1692, Jonathan Corwin and John, I believe, Hawthorne, led the Salem Town trials. And some more women had been accused by this point because Betty and Abigail's little friends decided to suddenly start having fits, coincidentally. And Cloyce and Proctor were yet more women who were accused of being witches.
It was basically a bad time to be a Sarah.
Yes, it was. Yeah, you name Sarah, you're probably going to be accused of being a witch. And keep in mind, listeners, there's a reason why I'm noting the judges' names. We'll get to that later. In May of 92, Massachusetts Governor William Phipps established the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which roughly translates to hear and determine, to handle witch trials in multiple counties, because Betty and Abigail apparently had quite a lot of influence that spread to multiple counties in the Massachusetts area, and they didn't have enough judges within each district to handle all of the witch accusations, and a bunch of people were being thrown in jail.
Great.
The members of Oyer and Terminer were William Stoughton, John Richards, Bartholomew Gedney, Waitzel Winthrop, Sam Sewall, Peter Sargent. There was another member named Nathaniel Staltonsall, but he was the only judge to resign because he thought the trials were a farce.
Nice.
He was good job, Nathan. Nathaniel. Nathan, that's my boy. But he was replaced by Jonathan Corwin. And on June 2nd of 1692, the Court of Oyer and Terminer had their first meeting. And Bridget Bishop was the first who was officially put on trial by this massive court. Another kind of influence that was behind all this and fueling the fire was a guy named Cotton Mather, who was in... Yeah, these names, I mean, they could have all been witches and wizards for the names that they had. Cotton was an influential Puritan minister who wrote an influential letter representing multiple ministers when the court asked for advice on how to deal with the witches. And he encouraged the use of what was called spectral evidence in court, which we'll get to a little bit in a little bit. And that drastically shot up the number of accusations and guilty verdicts. Cotton's father, who was an influential minister and president of Harvard, and his name was Increase.
What? Increase Mather.
Increase Mather. It was not amused by Cotton's advice, and he
decrease.
Increase did believe in witches, but he did not believe in using spectral evidence. And Cotton's letter, which I will not read, you can find online, but he had an 8-point plan, and the court ignored pretty much every point except the first one and the last two, because the first one and the last two were the ones that pretty much caused the mass hysteria. So Cotton's another one you can point the finger at. The executions that took place, first one was on June 10th, and that was poor Bridget Bishop. Then on July 19th, it increased to 5 individuals. On August 19th, there were another 5. And on September 22nd, there were 8. And there were many more who died in prison. And in addition to that, there was a very unfortunate guy named Giles Corey who refused to, when he was accused, he refused to plead guilty or not guilty. So they tortured him for 2 days by putting him between two wooden boards and dropping large wooden boulders on him until he died. His last words were, "More weight," and then he died.
What a badass, though.
Yeah, he was not amused by the whole witch business, and he died on September 19th. But on in October of 1692, Phipps finally disbanded the court of Oyer and Terminer. Probably not coincidentally, his wife had just recently been accused of being a witch.
Interesting.
So, got rid of the court. And in 1693, another court was established, the Superior Court of Judicature, which was formed more to actually pardon a bunch of people who were accused of being a witches, to basically cover up the screw-up. But sadly, Lydia Dustin, who was one of the accused, was the final victim of the witch trials. While she was not deemed guilty, she died in prison, sadly. To examine just how insane this was, as if the story wasn't enough, the way that they were accusing witches, the evidence that they were using, was just insane. The spectral evidence that I mentioned earlier was the idea that the accusers actually saw either the accused or visions of the accused, who harassed them and told them to do ungodly things. They also believed in effluvia, which were malignant particles, supposedly that came from a witch's eye, which a witch used to infect his or her victims and kind of stay connected to that victim. There was a touch test. If a witch touched their victim during a fit, which they did by blindfolding a bunch of accused witches and then having them around the girls when they were having a fit, the fit would stop, and that would mean that they were a witch because they had the ability to stop the fit.
Whoa.
A spectacular piece of evidence known as the witch's teat, which were blemishes on the afflicted that were insensitive to the touch. So basically, if you had a mole and somebody touched it and you didn't react, then you had been cursed by a witch.
Oh no.
Well,
I've been cursed by many a witch.
You and me both, Ariel. You and me both.
No.
And finally, the humdinger of them all.
This one bothers me.
The witch's cake. Which Ew. Is not as remotely delicious as one would hope. It is a cake made of rye. And if you didn't think that was bad enough, the other secret ingredient from the afflicted individuals of witches, urine. Which, when eaten by a dog, if a dog was fed a slice of this horrible, horrible cake, God bless
Why?
That
poor dog.
So
poor
many
dog.
I get that so many people suffered during the Salem witch trials, but let's talk about all the dogs that had to eat these things.
We don't deserve dogs.
Oh my gosh. I want to go hug my dog right now and be like, I'm sorry for your ancestors and what they were put through.
Yes, it would have been helpful if Newt was around during this time and he just would have been like, no, no, that's enough. You've gone too far.
Not the cake. Not the witch's cake.
But the idea was that when the dog ate the witch's cake, the witch would scream in pain because that goes back to the idea of the effluvia, because the effluvia was in the urine, because it was in the connected individual, and therefore the witch would still be connected, and she would experience pain when the dog ate the cake.
See, I have
maybe
trouble.
She was just sympathizing.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh no, why?
Sympathy pains. Sympathy pains. Imagine how you would feel if you had to eat that.
Like, why are you doing this to my dog?
Maybe she was crying because she had been accused of being a witch and her life as a Puritan just sucked on a daily basis.
It's hard out here for a witch. And a dog. And a Sarah.
It's a hard knock life for us.
It's a hard knock life for a witch. And with all of that said, that kind of helps, I feel, to slightly a little bit more clarify the involvement of the Salem witch trials in the wizarding world. Which, when you connect it to what Roland gave us on Pottermore about the Scourers actually predate the Salem witch trials, but they are in that kind of realm of time, as they did kind of what the idea was that they took advantage of the lack of law enforcement within the U.S. when the Puritans and the wizards came over to the U.S. And they simply just targeted. They started out by targeting people who had rewards out for them, but then they began to take advantage of that by targeting the innocent and collecting rewards. They were turning in both wizards and nomadges. They were developing a lust for violence against both wizards and nomadges. And capitalized on the fears of the Puritans, which, having explained the Puritans a little more, you can see how easy that probably was to do. And in Rowling's canon, at least two of those Salem judges were Scourers. So ladies, feel free to go through and decide which one of those judges had the most ridiculous names.
Okay, hold on.
And those are probably the wizards who were on, or the Scourers.
Waitsil Winthrop.
Waitsil Winthrop.
Man, hold on. Was Cotton Mather? He wasn't one.
No.
He was just a general asshole. I'm going to say Bartholomew Gedney. I don't know.
Yeah, I think Bartholomew Gedney's a kind of a winner on that one.
Because wasn't, Bartholomew Barebone was a Scourer. So, don't trust a Bartholomew.
Sarahs get accused of being witches and Bartholomews are just trouble.
Barty Crouch Jr.
Oh.
Sorry.
No, that's good. Now,
connection.
As Rowling put it, some individuals who were accused and hanged were indeed witches, though, of course, were innocent of any crime, while others were innocent nomadges. And you can find many accounts of many an accused witch and warlock who simply went to the gallows saying nothing. And I imagine in Rowling's view, those would probably be the witches and wizards who were taking a hit for the team, tragically. And there were many, many individuals who had impassioned speeches before they were hanged, including a few who almost swayed the crowd not to hang them, but, you know, the Puritans, they just, they were hard won. After the event, the magical community pretty much started to flee America en masse, and very few were coming over from Europe at that point, which caused a huge flux of nomad-born witches and wizards. And Makuza, in Rowling's world, was formed in 1693, pretty much right after the end of the Salem Witch Trials, as a direct response to the events, placing the Scourers on trial for what they did. And that, of course, leads into kind of what you guys were talking about with Mary Lou and her motivations. And what the idea is that the Scourers kind of ran from the hand of the law, disappeared into the nomad world to get away from being persecuted, and ended up having children with nomads and then weeding out their magical children, because, as has been seen, the Scourers seem to have no problem with violence and getting rid of people. So they were getting rid of their own magical children and keeping the non-magical children around, but telling the non-magical children that wizards existed and that they must take revenge on the wizards. And for, you know, trying to persecute them for killing people. So that is Mary Lou's... While we may not have much on Mary Lou, we now have, I suppose, a further understanding of why she believes what she believes. And I think... kind of what we were talking about before, Mary Lou is almost in a way meant to be representative of these Puritan ideals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yet again, it's just something that doesn't really come across. I guess it's almost meant to be assumed because they're called the Second Salemers.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't make much sense. But I personally found that this helped me to understand the concept of the Scourers a little better. I don't know how you ladies feel now.
You were reading. Ooh. Sorry, go for it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say I've always found this part of history fascinating for how terrifying it really is, like, you know, the whole mob mentality, like, oh yeah, there's witches, and that one over there, she's harassing me at night, like, just what two little girls started, and how it became such mass hysteria, like you said, it's crazy, it's, oh my gosh, I've always wanted to visit, you know, Salem and see all of the old places and everything, just to understand, like, not that I ever could, but to see that part of history, I suppose, because even though J.K. Rowling found a way to tie it into her own magical world, it's like, it's real, and it's scary to think about. Like, people actually had to deal with this. Like, neighbors would be accusing fellow neighbors of these crimes, and they could die just because of these accusations. And
Yeah.
You know, to soften the blow on Betty and Abigail just a little bit, it should probably be mentioned that it's possible that they were also being kind of goaded into it by their parents or by family members, because... their family had a feud with a family in Salem Town. Mm. And so there was kind of potentially a little bit of nudging on the adults' parts to make this happen. That's not necessarily confirmed. And I think one of the most important lessons, though, to take away from Salem is that there were very few people who stood up and said, this is wrong.
Yeah.
And... you know, the only reason it stopped is really because, one, somebody accused the governor's wife of being a witch, and people in power decided to use their influence in a different way. And two, because actually, I failed to mention that Increase, Cotton's father, helped to spread public opinion that this was actually not a good idea after a time. And turned the public against the concept of the Salem Witch Trials. listeners, if you've, and I just recently reread it myself with the recent TV series on Netflix, but if you've never specifically read book 7 of A Series of Unfortunate Events, The Vile Village, that is probably a much better parallel than the Salem, Second Salemers. The Vile Village is almost surely meant to be lifted from the Salem witch trials in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And speaking of books,
go ahead.
As you were saying the names, I'm sitting here having high school flashbacks. This story is The Crucible.
Yes.
Yeah, they do. They also go through and explain the story in a little bit more detail. And I was like, I know these names. Why do I know these names?
Yep.
And then it hit me. So that's another, if you want to learn more about what Michael was talking about, The Crucible goes into the story specifically.
Yeah, because wasn't Nathaniel Hawthorne a descendant of John Hawthorne's?
Possibly.
The thing to keep in mind about The Crucible is that Arthur Miller did kind of consolidate a few characters for dramatic purposes.
Yeah.
But it does give kind of an excellent, I think, excellent account of the feeling of that
event. Yeah, general overview.
Yeah, and how something like this could even come to be. And interestingly, Arthur Miller was using it as an echo of the McCarthy era, and the idea of calling people out during as communists during the 50s. And I would be so bold as to say that this whole story is still pretty relevant. Especially the idea that you can just take things that aren't facts and supposedly make them facts. So I'm sure the town of Salem would have loved the term alternative facts. They'd be so into that. But something to learn from, and I'm interested, you know, it's a little, that's still a part that I'm just eager to see what happens with it, because since Newt is leaving the U.S., at least for now, for the next film, I'm really intrigued to see if this does come up again, because of that potential relevance to current times, and how we know that Rowling is usually very aware of that and likes to insert it into her work. I felt like the commentary in Fantastic Beasts was a little soft, I guess, on that front. So I'd be interested to see if she continues to play with this more in that series, or if she's just done with it at this point.
Last note for, you know, all the insight I've given recently. my mom and my sister went to Salem like last summer, 2 summers ago or something. And ironically enough, they went into a shop, like a witch shop. Ooh. And what were they selling in there? Harry Potter merchandise.
That is fantastic.
So yeah, my mom's like texting me and she's like, you want this Butterbeer tank top? I was like, where are you? She's like, oh, they got all this stuff. And I was like, love that tank top, though. It's a great tank top. So if you ever go to Salem, you'll still find Harry Potter merch, which is great. So it all ties together in the end.
I'm sure the Salem the accused of Salem would approve of their legacy.
Harry Potter. Yeah.
They're like, really?
But hopefully that as we return back to the current time with our rule breaking time turner that can do whatever we want it to do. First child. hopefully that has cleared up a little bit of the damage that was done in our previous discussion. Mostly thanks to me and thanks to Potter's Moore's misleading artwork. I hope that you, the listeners, have learned a little bit more about the Salem Witch Trials and maybe have a little more curiosity to explore that. But speaking of things that we are curious to explore, Lizzie, I see that you're holding a very tattered suitcase.
I am, except it's not a suitcase. It's the Newt case.
Oh! That would explain why you're opening it on the floor and stepping inside it.
Yes, follow me. Clump, and like clump, if this was a 90s sitcom, this is where like the intro music would play in.
And we all get to stare at the camera as our name comes up. Yes.
Yeah, our faces appear inside circles.
Oh, man. So this week I'm actually going to talk about the Runespore, which was one of the beasts featured in the deleted scenes that did not make it into the movie. So there's actually surprisingly a lot of information on this beast, which I guess makes more sense as to why it was in production to be in the film and that it ended up being cut. So it's really cool. The first thing, before I even start to describe it, is that it's a rare Patronus on Pottermore, so you can actually have a Runespore as your Patronus. And as your Patronus, oh, that's very interesting in my notes. I wrote, actually a rare Patronus on Pottermore, and it can be a Patronus. Solid.
Interesting. You make very good points there.
I do.
Is it a Patronus, Lizzie?
I think it might be a Patronus.
It just might be. Who knew?
It's not my Patronus.
Said it twice. Must be thing. So it's a three-headed snake that's commonly 6 to 7 feet long, which is why Michael and I were saying when you see the deleted scene, the second Runespore that you see, it's a bit much. Definitely.
Yeah, what?
Definitely a bit larger than 7 feet. And it's usually colored yellow-orange with black bandings. And this is where we start to really get into it. So it's native to Burkina Faso, which is a tiny country in Western Africa. And the capital is Ouagadougou. So very interesting, this area of Africa. They actually have their own Ministry of Magic. And we recently learned about the wizarding school in Africa, which is Ouagadougou School of Magic. It's the largest of 11 wizarding schools. It takes students from all over Africa, and it sits atop the Mountains of the Moon in Uganda.
Ooh.
And this is just, I realize we haven't talked a lot about the wizarding school, so I don't know if this is previously known information, but I thought this was really cool. Students receive notice that they've gained entrance at Ouagadougou from dream messengers that are sent by the headmaster or headmistress of the day. So the dream messenger would appear to the children as they sleep and leave a token, usually an inscribed stone, which would be found in the child's hand upon waking. And this was the only such school that employed that method of student selection. So kind of like, yeah, right? That was really neat.
The best methods to get your notification.
Like, forget the owls. Give me a rock in my sleep.
I know. That's what I was just laughing about.
That is so cool. You wake up and you're like, oh my gosh.
It was real.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cute.
The funny thing about Ouagadougou, too, just to note, is that everybody was losing their minds when it was revealed on Pottermore, but she actually quietly gave away Ouagadougou's name in Book of Potions, which nobody played. But yes, Ouagadougou was first revealed in Book of Potions, along with the Russian school, which has not been revealed on Pottermore. The Russian school's name is Koldovstorets. So, yeah, there's more out there, you guys. I know you Australians are freaking out that you don't have a school. You'll get a school.
So many European schools.
I'm like, you can have ours. I'll go to Hogwarts.
So, since the Runespore were very easy to spot, the Ministry of Magic in Burkina Faso actually had to create several forests that were unplottable to put them. like they were just too big. They had to put them somewhere.
Yeah, they're trouble.
Yeah. So according to the writings from Parcel Mounts, each of the Runespore's heads served a different function. Yeah, did I mention that they had three heads?
Yes, I think so.
Also, yes, can they be a Patronus?
That's a good one. Have you used that material before? You only mentioned
it twice, and I feel like you should have mentioned it three times for each
I know, because there's three heads, so I have to mention it three times. That's very good. You should use that when you go on tour. Use that as your opener.
Yeah, I was planning on it. People get like, the f*** a rune spore.
Oh, that was good. Yes, they can be a Patronus. Just so you know. So, according to the writings from Parcel Mouths, each of the rune spore's heads serves a different function. The left head is the planner. It decides where the rune spore is to go and what it is to do next. The middle head is the dreamer. So apparently it's very common for a rune spore to remain stationary for days at a time, lost in glorious visions and imaginations. While the right head is the critic, whose fangs are highly venomous. It evaluates the efforts of the left and the middle heads with a continual irritable hissing. And it's actually common to see the far right head go missing, as the other two heads often band together to bite it off when it criticizes the other two heads too much.
Oh my gosh.
And because of this, rune spores rarely live to a great age.
Oh.
Oh man, I need to check in the deleted scene because one of the little rune spore, one of them is wearing a cone, like a dog cone.
Yeah.
On its neck.
The first rune spore that you see, it's a very young one, and the middle one is wearing a cone. And Newt says, he goes, "You know what you did." He goes, "You know why you're wearing that." He's like, maybe if you behave this time, you won't have to wear this anymore, which was really funny.
The cone of shame.
Yes, the cone of shame. The rune spore bears its young in eggs that it produces through its mouth. And it's the only magical beast known to do so.
Hmm.
The eggs
this
are
is
very-
horrible.
I'm like, okay.
Their eggs are very valuable in making potions to stimulate mental agility and have flourished on the black market for several centuries.
Mental agility. So maybe instead of making up the swooping evil, she could have tied in the rune spore instead. And the rune spore would have been just hiding in Newt's like sleeve the whole time. Totally
that
would have worked, you guys.
Terrifying. If all of a sudden you just see Newt having that by its tail and you got three heads hissing at you. Imagine if that was in 3D. I would cry.
I would be amazed. I would be amazed at that cleverness.
I would cry.
Damn that, JK. We love you.
If you combined the mental agility and the memory properties of the swooping evil, you've got a pretty good potion on your hands, I feel like. Yeah.
So you do see two rune spores in the deleted scene, and it is confirmed that he kept two in his suitcase, so that's six heads, if anybody was keeping score. Sometimes five, could be four. Depending on, you know, if, like, two of the heads have gone missing.
I think Newt's got a good handle on that, though. There's probably going to be
like, you two stop fighting.
All the shame for all.
He probably leaves the case, and he's like, there had better be six heads in this case when I come back.
I will turn this suitcase around.
On the floor, and then it'll be facing the other way. I sure showed you.
They're like, no. But dad.
And then, so there are several places in the Potter universe where you can find the rune spore. First is the Fantastic Beasts textbook, and Newt labels it with four X's, which is dangerous, requires specialist knowledge, skilled wizard may handle.
And I believe there's a picture ambitious. Of it in the book, isn't there?
There is, and it's not ugly, but it's not pretty. So
it just is.
It's a face a mother could love. That is what it is.
It is not as big as the movie's version.
No, not at all. And then, of course, you can see in the deleted scene in the film. Apparently, it's also in Lego Dimensions, which I haven't played yet. So when I get to, and who knows how long time, but I look forward to seeing them there. And then it's also in the mobile game that came out, the Cases from the Wizarding World. So they like tried to make them more relevant because there's like this whole history on Potter Wiki about how it bites the main characters in that game. But I haven't played. I don't really know. Sorry. But it seems like they just tried to make them more involved in this in that game, considering they got cut from the movie.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so if you've played the game and you've encountered them, let us know how it went.
I started playing the game, but then my phone decided to delete all of my data or everything I had saved.
Oh, no.
So I had to start from all over again, and I got frustrated, so I didn't start playing it again. But I hadn't gotten that far.
See, that happened to me with Pokemon.
So you didn't see a rune spore?
I hadn't gotten to the rune spore yet.
See,
maybe I will now, just to figure it out.
I'm assuming that with them being included in the game, that probably gives us an indication of just how late some of these scenes might have been taken out. Because if they were included in extra material, in LEGO Dimensions too, because I know Dimensions and the LEGO people work very hard to make those games very close to their inspirations. I'm assuming that probably means those scenes were pulled pretty late. And that would certainly, the additional thing that probably hints at that is that they are fully animated in the deleted scene. They're finished. Unlike the Demiguys, which is not finished in his deleted scene. So,
yeah, definitely go watch the scene on MuggleNet, because it's such a quick thing that they could have left it, but it was definitely cut just for time. Like, just to cut corners at that point where they needed to, like, shave off 15 seconds here and there. So they had to take it out. Because they're pretty cool to look at, even though they're huge and frightening and have three heads. You know?
I feel like I'm looking forward to listener comments of just every which way that people are just reacting to, like, whoa, that is absurdly huge. That's ridiculous. Why?
So that wraps it up for the new case. Time for us to step on up that ladder, get out of there. We'll come back next time, go down the rabbit hole. For this episode's podcast question, we want to know, now that we've explored the Salem witch trials further and really dug into that history, do you feel this validates or takes away from J.K. Rowling's explanation of the second Salemers? And also, how do you feel this might be involved in future films, if it is at all? So think on that and send in your fantastic theories, comments, questions, or, you know, just say hi. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl or on any of our social media outlets and email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. Stephanie, thanks for coming back. We're happy to have you.
Thank you, Steph.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be back.
Good. So
she keeps us grounded.
Yeah. Absolutely.
She is a no-nonsense gal.
She is our lightning
rod. I'm
good
for nonsense. Let's just bang out what we gotta do first, and then let's do things.
Yeah, like, she spontaneously gave me a tattoo once. Y'all don't even know.
Oh my god.
It was insane. I was like...
Literally the first day I met you.
I know. I was like, we just met, and you're giving me a tattoo. Like, I don't know. It's a bit sudden, but I'll roll with it.
Dang. I feel like our first meeting was so pale by comparison. I complimented your overalls.
I'm
just gonna carry around temporary tattoos now. So the first time I meet anybody from MuggleNet, I'm just gonna give them a
She'll be ready.
Yes. They'll be like, "What are you doing? This is my thing. I give people tattoos."
All right.
Sorry.
All right. So, Steph, how about you tell everyone where they can find us?
Okay, leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to know what you think of us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBC, on Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBC, on Tumblr at SpeakBC Podcast, speakbeastie.tumblr.com. You can check out our website, speakbeastie.com, and we are on Patreon.
I'm Ariel.
I'm Michael.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Stephanie. Case closed.